Today is March 25th, 1985. My name is Tika Ward. I'm interviewing Michael Kirk. Our interview is taking place at Top House, home of the Little Loom House in Kenwood Hill, Louisville, Kentucky. Our topic is Lou Tate and the Little Loom House. As we begin, tell me a little something about yourself.
My name is Michael Kirk. I was born here in Louisville. I met Lou Tate almost 20 years ago. It was here in 1965. I was born in Louisville, but grew up in southern Indiana. Moved back here to Louisville as a kid, and went to high school at Butler High School here in Louisville. And I met Lou through a very close high school friend who used to live across the road from me. So that was how I met Lou.
Who was that?
Maury Weedman. Okay, as I was saying, I met Lou through my friend Maury. His family moved to Kenwood Hill when he was and I were both juniors in high school, I think. And the first time I came up to Kenwood Hill, I was just amazed at how different the atmosphere was here because of all the trees and the fact that it was on the hill. And the first time I ever saw the place, I said, "What's that across the street?" And I was just absolutely fascinated by the cabins up here on the hill. And Maury had already been across the way and had met Lou, and he told me that there was this very interesting and extremely eccentric old lady who lived across the road. And being an adventurous youth, I was very eager to meet Lou. And so Maury and I trooped up the hill, as many other kids of all ages have over the years. And I met Lou, and it was kind of almost an immediate love affair. I just thought she was marvelous. I think the thing that attracted me so much was that I must have been 15 years old at the time, was that she was just so different from anyone else I'd ever met. She lived up on the hill, almost a hermit-like existence. She drove a wonderfully crazy old 1953 Ford station wagon. It was blue and every corner was banged up because when she pulled into the garage, she would invariably run into the corner of the garage, and so the car was just, you know, full of dents. And she didn't have a kitchen. That just flabbergasted me. She invited us in, I believe. I can't remember if she did. Lou was real funny. Not many people got invited in. It was a real sign that you were part of her quote-unquote family if you got to go into the lower house. She'd open it up from time to time, but when it was all cleaned up. But if you were allowed in when it was a wreck, then you were one of the special people. She used to call Maury and myself, and for that fact, Bob Douglas and other people, her little boys or her kids, because since she never married and really didn't have any close family in the Louisville area, you know, friends kind of filled certain needs in her life. Maury and I did a lot of, you know, odds and odd jobs for her over the years. We dug ditches and hauled railroad ties and planted bulbs and sawed down trees. And one summer we helped put a new foundation under the middle house. That's the only thing that's kept Wisteria Cabin standing, is we helped put a concrete block wall in down there. And we helped dig out the drainage ditches up above Top House. And we hauled railroad ties to help hold back the hill as it slowly encroached on the place. And over the years, we helped her dig bulbs and replanted things and trim trees and shrubs. And one summer, another friend, John Kuiper, his wife Ann Kuiper, was a lifelong friend of Lou's. Her mother and Lou were very good friends in their youth. John's from Western Kentucky and likes to do barbecue, and so we built the barbecue pit down the hill. That it was a mind-expanding experience because the earth up here is, you know, about an inch of earth over rock. So to build the foundation for it, it took us about 4 days of digging with picks and shovels and everything else to get all the stone out of the ground. So this little project that we thought would just, you know, be an afternoon's lark turned into something akin to building the Great Pyramid. It's dragged on for about 6 months before we finally got it all done. But after that was done, we did have a lot of fun over the years cooking out up here. Since Lou didn't have a kitchen, whenever she had a big open house, people would all bring potluck. Everybody would bring a dish of something or other, and usually she would buy a couple of hams or chickens or something like that and get John or someone like that to come up and barbecue them. So she would provide the meat for the get-together, and then you know, everyone else would bring different kinds of salads and things like that. There, generally at open houses, there was pink lemonade too. That was an old tradition. And there was an old glass punch bowl, I think it's still around somewhere, that we used all the time. And, after the children left, who'd been weaving during the day, every once in a while somebody would slosh in some gin or vodka, and the pink lemonade would become an adult drink at that point. Lou, a great lady, very interesting. I think one of the reasons I kept coming back over the years were her stories. I just loved to listen to her. Lou, it just always boggled my imagination, people she had known, things she had done, and again, her very basically unconventional lifestyle, from my point of view, you know, that she was single, that she had chosen a career rather than having a family, and that, you know, her interest in weaving and folk history, she was extremely knowledgeable, and she did research work for universities and different foundations and things like this. I believe she did some work for Wittenauer. People would, she was really a recognized authority in the field of weaving, and people all over the country used to send her samples and little bits and fragments of things and ask her if she could tell them about when it was produced, what the materials were, what was the name of the pattern, and these sorts of things. But she never really made any money off of all this, and I don't think money was ever very important to her at all. She loved this place. She loved living up here on the hill. When she first moved here back in the 1920s, it was really practically the only house on the hill. There was an old log cabin up the hill that Hal and Kitty Tenney later bought, and down the hill in the other direction was a lovely old house that was still owned by the Ledeans, Dr. and Mrs. Ledean. But other than that, it was really the woods. And she loved the hill. She loved the history of the area. She always told the story that it was originally known as Sunshine Hill, which was an Indian name. And the other side of the hill, facing south, was said to be used by the Indians during their summer hunts. They would meet there and preserve some of the catch, you know, smoke the meat and things. And I remember trips over to the other side of the hill to dig up arrowheads and things like that. So it was very fascinating. Being around Lou, there was always a new story and interesting variations on old stories. But I was always amazed that her background, she didn't study weaving. Her college work was in history. And that's how she got into weaving, was doing historical research. And she did her undergraduate work at Berea College, and I believe had some exposure to weaving there. But then later, when she went to the University of Michigan to work on her master's degree, her thesis advisor and she were talking, and They kind of came up with this idea of her doing her thesis on early American weaving and how it related to early American history. Many of the old coverlet patterns have names that give them a historical reference, like Whig Rose refers to the Whig political party, and some of the patterns are called like Federal City. It's a pattern that's organized in squares, and it looks like some of the old maps of some of the first United States cities of how they were organized in neat grid works and patterns. Another pattern that she was very fond of was called Bonaparte's March Across the Rockies, which is involved in a long tale that I've forgotten a lot of, about a plot that the French had to overthrow the colonies through a surprise attack from the West. And all this, you know, she could just tell you these stories by the hours about how it related to this and that and the other. And I've always been interested in history myself, and so Lou was like a living history book to me. You know, I picked up all these interesting tidbits here and there. And she was just a natural teacher. Through her stories, you were learning. If you admired something, she would immediately start to explain how it was made, why it was made, what the techniques were. And she was just such a vivacious, interested person. She was very vivacious and energetic, and her enthusiasm about things were absolutely infectious. And she was tangential to a certain extent, but I think all brilliant people are. If Lou had been a straight ahead type person, I'm sure she would have gone toward money and things like that. But she would go off on little side tracks of things that interested her, and that was part of the fascination of being around her. I remember a conversation once about, she had showed me some things that had been done with vegetable dyes, and they were so beautiful, the colors, and they were so different from the harsher, brighter colors of commercial dyes. And from that conversation, over the next couple of years, she kind of developed the whole program up here of vegetable dyeing, and people would come out and experiment, and you'd meet other people. It was like a ripple effect, and Lou was like a magnet that drew people around, and then you'd meet these other interesting people, and so it became like a really extended family. I remember going out on the hill here and just all over the place and collecting weeds, goldenrod, jewelweed, things like this, chopping them up, boiling them down for dyes, and then coming out and doing dyeing demonstrations and things like that. So there was always something wild, wonderful, and wacky going on. I mean, I'd come up here, with things hanging out of the trunk of my car, and just do nutso things. But it was great fun, and as I say, it was kind of like a not a carnival atmosphere. That's the wrong connotation, but Lou's always doing something that was really interesting, and I think more people, children and adults as well, learn more of the flavor of history out here than they ever did in a classroom situation, because Lou always believed in history as a living thing, and that people needed to experience things and not just watch. That was always a biggie with her. She always called things she did a program in action. She hated doing demonstrations. In fact, one time she was invited to do a thing in Washington, D.C. I think it was affiliated with the Smithsonian. And she refused to do it because all they wanted her to do was to bring a group of people up to do demonstrations. And she said if people couldn't get involved and do a hands-on situation, she didn't want to be involved with it. And people criticized her for not doing that because they said, the publicity would be wonderful and everything. But that was Lou. If Lou got her head set on something, nothing could dissuade her from her chosen path. But I helped over the years with many, many of her open houses. where people were invited up to, you know, to weave and experience different things, and I'd help, you know, get things ready and make signs and put signs up and get people up the hill and, you know, just kind of a helper. And it was always fascinating. I'm not much of a weaver myself. I probably never wove more than a few inches of anything up here, but I'm fascinated by textiles, and mostly through knowing Lou and learning to look at things. That was a very important factor of my interest with Lou, was there were always neat things around to look at, and she, I'm an artist now and was interested in art in high school. I took a lot of art classes, and Lou, as much as anyone, taught me how to look at things. And she would have just interesting things around. I'm looking now at this weaving across the room, which is a South American backstrap weaving, and just the fact that you know, it includes the loom itself and the use of figures and animals, and she'd have things from she had wonderful molas, which are a special kind of cut applique technique from, I believe, Panama. And she'd have pieces of cloth from India, and she'd compare and contrast, look how this culture did this and this culture does that. And so I really, as I say, I learned so much about history and different cultures and civilizations through Lou's eyes and through the history of cloth making. And as she pointed out, weaving, if you study the history of weaving, you're studying the history of civilization in many ways through the techniques, the approaches to it. She had little bits and fragments of very ancient things. She had Navajo rugs, and you know, you could, it was just wonderful the way you could look at these things and start to pull ideas together, and how, you know, cultures were similar. You know, that American Indian weaving looks a lot like Southeast Asian weaving and certain design motifs. And in fact, many years later, when I was working with the Louisville Art Gallery at the main library here in Louisville, we did a show of work by the Laotian Hmong, a tribal group from the mountains of Laos. And I was just bowled over. Their work looked so much like some of the South American work I had seen up here on the hill. And I did a little research on my own at that point about certain design motifs and how geometry is a very natural form in weaving because of the nature of the threads. It's much easier to weave a geometric pattern than a flowing, curving pattern. And there are just remarkable similarities between different cultures and their approaches to weaving. Greek weaving and South American weaving can be very similar at times.
Were you interested in art before you met Lou Tate?
Oh yeah, I was very interested. I had taken art and been interested in art all through my early years, but Lou kind of put a different flavor and a different slant on it just by introducing, again, she collected all kinds of stuff, and she had actually it was her nephew, but his name was Wood Bousman, and but she called him her kid brother, and he was a career army person, and he spent a lot of his time in the Orient, and he would send her interesting things from Japan and such, sometimes just odd things like fish kites. And the first time I saw a wisteria cabin in the center hallway, the ceiling was filled with fish paper and cloth fish kites. It was just magical. You always came up here and there was something neat to look at. She'd have her, you know, old family pottery and china out with flowers in it, and next to that would be an old hat pin stuck in something, and next to that would be a clay pot that some kids had made because that one day they just decided, hey, let's make some pottery, you know. And that's what I mean about the tangential, that things just kind of flowed out in a ripple effect. And so there was always something interesting to see, and nature things, you know, and somehow seeing them up here, I started to appreciate a wider outlook, you know, seashells and gourds and just seeing interesting things. And she would use these for design inspiration or like there are maracas around when she loved music, and people would sometimes come up and bring their guitars to open houses, and especially in the evening after everything was over, people would play the guitar and Lou would get the maracas out and play along. There was one person she was particularly fond of named Alfredo Martinez, a Mexican who's lived here in Louisville for many years, and Alfredo would come out and play, and that was always, he'd come out quite often, and that was always very exciting. And his wife would come out and do some weaving and such. So over the years, through Lou, I met many, many fascinating people. I met Hal and Kitty Tenney, who used to live up the hill on Possum Path, kind of through Lou and through Maury. And these people have, you know, been important parts of my life for many, many years now. And, you know, many of the people I still see on a regular basis. And it's always been, I met Bob Douglas up here. He used to live on the other side of the hill. And he came up here as a kid, a really quite a young person, and studied weaving. And so there were always interesting people up here, as well as, you know, Lou herself. And so she, again, I guess I've used this word before, it seemed like she was a magnet that attracted interesting people, and then just interesting things kind of developed from that interaction.
Did she ever talk to you about the early days of the Little Loom and how it came about?
Yes. Lou, I believe, as I can piece it together, that the Little Loom was actually a suggestion of Mrs. Herbert Hoover. After Lou graduated from college, she worked one summer in a school in Virginia, a mountain school. It was a settlement school run by the Hoovers. It was kind of a private, charitable sort of thing that they did. And Mrs. Hoover pointed out that if the women in the area could do some kind of work in their home, they could still, you know, be homemakers, but it could they could supplement their income. And weaving was an important part of the heritage of that area, as it is in Kentucky. And but many people at that point, this would be the early 20s, had forgotten a lot about weaving. In fact, there would be looms in houses, but nobody could thread them anymore. They'd forgotten how to thread the looms. But some of them still knew how to weave if someone else would thread the looms. And that's how Lou got involved in some of her early research. Was she'd go up in the mountains and the hills and hollows and ask people if there were any looms, and if there were, would often be old weaving drafts around, which were usually little thin, long strips of paper with marks on them that would show the patterns. And Lou would barter and say, you know, if you'll let me copy all the weaving patterns, I'll thread the loom for you. But anyway, getting back to the development of the Little Loom, Lou worked with a doctor, and I've forgotten his name now, here in Louisville, and they worked on several different designs for a simple, portable, small loom. And the Little Loom House comes from the Little Loom, because this was a small, relatively inexpensive loom that could be used in the home, and, you know, women could weave placemats and small pieces on it. Some of the larger pieces out here, like the coverlets and such, can actually be woven on these looms in strips, and then they're sewn together into larger pieces. But she worked for several years on the development of the loom, and when she perfected the finished design, which is the one that's still being used now, I saw this once in helping sort through old papers and such, that she wrote a letter to Herbert Hoover, explaining how Mrs. Hoover had been helpful and suggestions and such. And I believe she sent some of her early booklets and pamphlets to him to show, you know, how it all paid off. There are There's a wonderful scrapbook somewhere around that has photographs of her experiences there in Virginia, showing them at the school and with some of the different people. And there's some note cards that were in the scrapbook along with the photographs that are just kind of remembrances of things that went on. There's a wonderful story that the president, Mr. Hoover, maintained a summer home near the settlement school. And one night, the teachers at the school were invited for dinner with the president and Mrs. Hoover, and they'd been out berry picking all day, and they'd all eaten all these berries, and none of them were hungry, but in the note it said, Blues said you couldn't very well tell the president you weren't hungry, so they went and, you know, kind of pretended that they ate all of this, but they didn't eat much. I think that was another one of the things that fascinated me, because Lou knew the Hoovers and the Roosevelts, and woe for both of them, and as I say, I've always been a history buff, and so these personal insights to people like that I don't, you know, read about in history books and such always fascinated me. In fact, the story goes that Mrs. Hoover actually kind of gave Lou her name, as it were. Lou's name was Louisa Tate Bousman, and she was at the White House once in a receiving line, and Mrs. Hoover was introducing her to people, and after a while, the Louisa Tate Bousman got to be a real mouthful, and Mrs. Hoover turned to her and said, from now on, you're just plain Lou Tate, and this worked out really well, because it was a little snappier than Louisa Tate Bousman. And it's also interesting that Lou threw people off because they didn't know whether it was a man or a woman. And in those days, master weavers were often men. And there are quite a few things, old letters around here that are addressed to Mr. Lou Tate. So people, it kind of kept people wondering. Lou was a very brilliant lady. I think it was easy to kind of get lost in her eccentricity and admire that part of her, but she knew so much about history, and she had a very strong logical mind. Weaving is really a very mathematical process, and you have to be a very logical person and understand some of these mathematical concepts in order to understand the true structure of weaving. And Lou could just look at a little tiny sample of a piece of fabric and tell you how the loom was threaded, what the treadling pattern was, which petals you had to press down to get this kind of pattern going. And she taught to some of the advanced students draft reading and analysis. And again, she could just look at a piece and just bam, she knew how it was made. She understood the underlying structure. And that always amazed me, because I don't think that I'm a particularly logical or mathematically oriented person. So that was always fascinating.
This is the end of side one, take one. This is side two of tape one with Michael Kirk on Lou Tate and the Little Loom House.
I believe I left off on the other side talking about Lou's mathematical bent and the fact that she was very logical and her ability to analyze structure and mathematical things. It's interesting, here's another aside, that during the war she did design work for the Army. She actually did drafting for aircraft production, I believe. So Lou was a multi-talented lady. During the war, she also, I believe she was an honorary member of each area of the armed forces. She had an honorary commission in the Army, the Marines, the Navy, and the Air Force. And part of this came about because she did work after the war with physical therapy. To my knowledge, she was one of the earlier pioneers in using weaving as a form of occupational therapy for wounded soldiers. Found out that certain types of things that they did were very good for restoring muscle coordination and control. She did a lot of work out at Fort Knox in those years. She told me one time that she'd met George Patton at a party out at Fort Knox, and she thought he was really pompous. And, again, the interesting people she'd met over the years. I think another slant besides the Army work, and this was kind of a tie-in, again, with the Roosevelts, was that she had continued this idea of trying to teach people weaving to supplement their income, a cottage industry, as it were, and this was a real interest of Mrs. Roosevelt's. During the Depression years, the WPA and all that, Mrs. Roosevelt pursued a lot of different possibilities of ways that people could help themselves, and in fact, she helped underwrite a furniture industry or factory in New York near their home at Hyde Park. And some very, very beautiful things were produced there. And I know that Mrs. Roosevelt visited Kentucky several times to see what was happening here at the Loom House. And I believe, you know, Lou traveled back and forth somewhat, and she actually did a design for table linens for the Roosevelts. And I've seen it around somewhere. It still exists around here, some of the samples that were exactly like the linens she produced for the Roosevelts. She also did table linens for the Hoovers, and this is kind of how, you know, she met some of these people, because I believe at that time there weren't many people doing custom hand-woven things. It took so long that you could never really make much money at it. Of course, you know, dollars then and now are very different things, but you would put in an amazing amount of time to produce a finely woven piece of cloth, and you know, you just couldn't make money at it. But there are linen tablecloths around here, the very finest white damask linen that was woven by Lou in these really incredibly intricate patterns, and many of the patterns were variations of the early American coverlet designs, and she would translate them into a very finely woven linen, as opposed to the original design, which would have been in a much heavier yarn, so it would have been a bedspread, but then she translated the design. In fact, the Hoover design was a fine linen cloth, but it was, I believe, a variation of what is called the chariot wheel pattern, which is a series of quasi-circular designs, and it was done in a real interesting kind of rainbow pattern of colors and white, so that it had kind of a, you know, pink bleeding into yellow, into blue, into pale green. So it was a very handsome pattern.
Did she talk very much about her childhood or her youth or her time at Berea?
She didn't talk too much about Berea. For some reason, she had must have had a falling out over the years with Berea about something. I believe there was some tension because Berea later got into weaving, and I don't know if she considered the program at Berea kind of a, not a threat, what am I trying to say, somewhat conflictual, and everybody knew about Berea, and I don't know. Sometimes maybe she didn't feel like she had gotten the appreciation that she should have. I suppose, you know, the whole field of folk weaving and folk history and all that is fairly specific, and you know, certain people would be very interested in it. She talked somewhat about her early years. I remember that she, I believe she was born in Bowling Green, or was it Virginia? I believe she spent some time in Bowling Green and then moved to Louisville. She talked a fair bit about her family. I think they were a relatively close family. Her father and mother were important people in her lives. Her father was a railroad man. I can't believe, remember if he was an engineer or a conductor, but I believe he worked for the old L&N Railroad. And they lived in Old Louisville in her childhood, out on 3rd Street. And the place up here on the hill was bought as kind of a summer residence. And I believe her parents helped her buy it. And she bought it in the 20s, and at that time they only used it as kind of summer and on the weekends. And, you know, I learned all about the history of who had built and owned this place over the years. At one time it was a summer artist colony. And before that, the lower house, which we always called the Loom House, was used as a church. And I believe the name for the house, Esta, has religious meanings. I can't remember exactly what they are. Her mother, I believe, had a long illness, and Lou helped nurse her through all that. And after her mother died, I think she kind of took care of her father. So she had a lot of family obligations related to that. And she had an elderly maiden aunt that lived with them. So it was kind of the old-fashioned, tight-knit family. That could be one of the reasons why we never married. I'm not really sure on that. She'd talk about an occasional beau here and there, but she never really said much about any of the great love interests in her life. She had such a mischievous sparkle in her eye. I can't imagine that she wasn't a popular young lady. And in older pictures of her, I think she was really quite an attractive woman. When I knew Lou, I don't know that I ever knew exactly how old she was, but she always wore her hair the same way, which was kind of a funny little page boy cut. It looked like she kind of put a soup bowl on her head. She wore bangs, and I'm sure she cut it herself. And she always wore very plain, simple dresses. She had arthritis and gout pretty badly by the time I knew her. And she'd wear tennis shoes because those were the only thing that were comfortable. I never saw her in anything other than tennis shoes. And a lot of times she'd go barefooted or just wear socks because her feet would really hurt her because of the arthritis. And she'd walk up the hill in her socks. I'm trying to think more about stories of her childhood.
Did you get the distinct impression that she had really graduated from the University of Michigan with a degree in history, or do you think she just studied toward her master's?
I'm not really sure on that. I kind of thought that she had gotten a degree, but in retrospect, perhaps she just studied. I don't know if she did actually finish the degree or not. I suppose there would be ways of looking up old records in certain years.
But she would never say, I actually...
I don't think she ever said, I earned my master's degree at...
She didn't talk about herself a lot.
Yes and no. It's hard to, she wouldn't sit down and approach that as the topic of a conversation, but little bits and pieces would come out. And when I talk to interesting people like that, I ask a lot of questions, so I would pull some of these things out in the conversations. I guess I was always under the impression that she had earned the master's at Michigan. And again, you know, in that day, I suppose it was fairly unique. You know, not everybody went to college, much less earned a master's degree. And again, a woman in that day, it was, you know, fairly unusual. I think just the fact that, you know, Lou was interested in her own thing and turned it into a small business, over the years in terms of, you know, doing the custom weaving for different people, and then the research, which was always, she said, was very important to her. she loved delving into all that, but she didn't have the kind of mind that put it together. She did all these interesting pages of data, and there are thousands of them around here, but she really never published any large volumes or anything like that. She published a couple of small books, several of them on Kentucky coverlets, and I think one book was called Weaving is Fun. And in its day, it was probably a very unique book, and I'm sure lots of people that came after her stole prodigiously from the work she did, but she didn't put it all together the way later people did. But again, you know, she was a real authority, and the people in the field knew her. I mean, if you had a degree in weaving or early American, you know, it would pop up. I remember she did a very nice article for Antiques Magazine one time on Kentucky coverlets, when Antiques Magazine did a whole issue on antiques in Kentucky. And a lot of museum people knew her. It was like she had different lives. You know, there was the professional life and then the life here in Louisville. And I don't think people understood how widely she was known in certain very small circles, but she talked of knowing people at different museums around the country and how they would sometimes, you know, write her and answer questions, or they'd correspond back and forth. She had a friend at the Metropolitan Museum at one time who was a textile curator and would send her little bits and samples of, she once showed me a piece of weaving that was an Egyptian Coptic fragment, just a little tiny thing, but it was, you know, dated around 800, so it was, you know, over 1,000 years old. And then all these wonderful early American coverlets and little pieces of things, you know, these things are hundreds of years old, some, you know, dating back to the pre-revolutionary times. And, you know, not that she didn't respect them, but they weren't precious. It was part of the living tradition of this place. You know, if you had a coverlet, you used it. You know, and Lou would hang them on the walls down in the lower house, keep drafts out in the winter. So you'd walk in and find all these things that probably museums would die for, and, you know, they were just hanging on shower curtain hooks to keep drafts out. So, you know, she respected the history of it, but she didn't have the kind of scholarly respect that it was precious. She always said she never wanted this place turned into a museum. You know, she wanted it to be a living, functioning place. That if, you know, if someone couldn't keep it going, where kids could come up here and learn weaving, you know, they might as well just give it all to the Smithsonian and forget about it. Because she often made comments that she hated historical houses with red velvet ropes marking everything off and making it all very precious. She liked the idea of a place where things, you know, kept on going, like Colonial Williamsburg. She was very impressed with what they'd done there. I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't advise them, for example, on, you know, weaving and such. I remember one time she was telling me that during the 1960s, the State Department sent people from Africa here, Kansas State and such. Again, these people were trying to establish industries in their country, you know, to maintain the folk heritage of weaving. And so, you know, Lou taught people and advised them. And, you know, again, there were just many things she was involved in that I don't think any one person has a total handle on it.
Did she ever tell you about going to Nova Scotia or Chicago or different places?
I remember she had some very good friends in Nova Scotia, and she went up there and she did a little book, I believe, on Cape Breton designs, which, and she corresponded back and forth, met a couple of people that lived in Nova Scotia and would come down from time to time for some of the big open houses during the summer. She also did a book, I think, on algebraic equations in weaving that I believe was a collaboration with one of those Nova Scotia people. In the 30s, an exhibition was done at the Speed Museum of work done out here, and I think it was called something like Contemporary Hand Weaving. And it premiered here in Louisville and then moved to Chicago to the Marshall Fields Department Store. And it was considered very avant-garde stuff at that time. and I believe there's some old copies of the original brochure on the speed show here. And in fact, in going through the stuff, we found some of the original pieces that were in that show and traveled to Chicago. I think that Lou probably did some work over the years with industry, you know, advising textile mills on designs and things like this. And I always thought it would have been wonderful if she could have. There again, I think there was a side of her that didn't want to pursue it in the right way, as we would call it today, the business way or the aggressive way. But, you know, if she could have worked with some of these huge textile firms, Burlington Mills or something like that, to come out with a Lou Tate collections of, you know, historically accurate reproductions of some of these old patterns, it would have been great for history and great for the weaving industry too, because so many of these things are so beautiful and they could be done in, you know, current colors and things like that. And I think people would be, there's a lot of interest now in, you know, there are a lot of magazines on colonial living and things like that, where people, you know, who are really into the authentic early American antiques and such. And it would have been a great moneymaker. But again, I don't know that that was all that important to Lou. And
why do you think it wasn't that important to her? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, I think basically she liked her lifestyle the way it was. It wasn't an easy lifestyle, but perhaps she just didn't want to get involved in the rat race. She liked people coming here. Lou was pretty old by the time I met her, and she was not in particularly good health. She'd had a heart attack, and I think she'd slowed down a great deal. I mean, her real periods of activity were in the 20s, 30s, and the 40s. See, I didn't meet her until 65, so she was pretty old by then. And at that point, I think her interest had turned more to working with kids. She loved working with little kids. She developed a little experimental loom she called the kindergarten loom. And she had, I mean, literally toddlers weaving on those. And, you know, you'd always come up here and find little kids working on weaving. And I think that she always enjoyed that. And I think it helped her kind of keep her young, you know, this interaction with kids. She's awfully good with kids. Kind of no nonsense in certain ways, and yet there was a very whimsical side to her. Lou was like that. I think a lot of people couldn't figure her out, and she had a pretty bad temper. If you ever made Lou really angry, she didn't get over it very quickly. I think that was a problem over the years, you know, that she kind of burned her bridges, as it were. But she interacted really well with kids. The kids acted well for Lou. I mean, they wouldn't think of really being destructive or anything like that around her. You know, they were fascinated with what she had to offer and listen. And not that they didn't have fun. She loved to have fun and with kids. And part of what she called the adventures in cloth making, she'd have grass skirts hanging up, and the kids could wear those, and they'd have old costumes they could wear. And part of her turning kids on to history would be, you know, thinking about, you know, primitive man and what did man first use for clothing before there was weaving. And she'd have old animal skins, old moth-eaten animal skins, and the kids could, you know, and what, you know, 20th century kid has ever felt a bobcat skin? And then she'd make yarns. She'd call them grandpappy yarns, folktale sorts of things, up about them, you know, about how the wildcat was caught up on the hill and, you know, someone scared the skin off of it, and, you know, just interesting tales that most city kids would never come in contact with. They did a bunch of weavings related to rabbits up here. She called it the Harvey pattern, the disappearing rabbit. And that was all based on, there was a family of rabbits that lived down in one of the gullies here in the ravines, and everybody loved watching the little baby bunnies. And that's what I mean again about her kind of going off in these wonderful little paths of different things. And, you know, whatever really caught her imagination, I think she wanted to be free to go ahead and pursue that path. And I think that's one of the reasons, this is getting very drawn out, but I think that's one of the reasons that maybe she didn't zero in on some of these other things that could maybe have made money or whatever. It would have locked her into that rather than giving her the freedom. Lou was a very free person. I mean, you know, she didn't live by anybody else's standards. I mean, you know, as I said, I was amazed she didn't have a kitchen. She cooked for out here for over 30 years on a hot plate. It was never that important to her to have a stove, you know. You know, if she had the money to spend, she'd go out and buy yarn or order, you know, new looms or something like that rather than, you know, worry about a stove in the kitchen. She really had her own lifestyle, her own schedule. You'd often see the lights on very, very late at night. I know because of the arthritis and everything that she didn't sleep very well. She'd get real stiff, so she'd get up and down during the night. And when Maury and I were kids, teenagers, we'd go out to movies or whatever, bug around, and it'd be real late when we'd get back, and you'd still see Lou's lights on up the hill, and sometimes we'd come up really late and, you know, sit around and talk with her. It was kind of a very, you know, the door was always open. She loved murder mysteries, and when she'd get up in the night, that was something we used to do. We occasionally would take their books back to the library for her and things like that. But she was very close with the closest library, I guess it's the Iroquois Branch Library, and I'm sure she'd read every murder mystery in that library a dozen times. She'd forget if she'd read it or not and get halfway through and go, oh, I've read that one. But there was always a huge pile of murder mysteries next to her bed. She'd get up and read murder mysteries and type a little and work on this and that. And, you know, it was just her own schedule.
Were you here for the Landmarks celebration, or did she ever talk to you about it?
Yes, I was. I was in college at that time down at Murray, majoring in art, but I came up specifically for that. And she was always very, very pleased that that had happened. And I believe Bob Douglas was very instrumental in getting the Bloomhouse placed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it always thrilled her that that had happened. See, there's another thing. I think she'd started doing it and then never kind of followed through on all the paperwork, and then Bob came in and pulled all the information together, put it in the right forms, and it often the place was declared a national landmark and a state landmark and a local landmark. And she's always very proud of that status and hoped that, you know, that would help in the preservation of the cabins. She always wanted this place to be preserved. She didn't, wanted to become a, you know, museum, but she always hoped that there would be some help through local historic organizations like the Landmarks Commission and such to try to help preserve the physical facility here.
Do you, as she became older, how did you find her becoming?
Well, I think Lou became kind of bitter late in her life. I think part of it was she was in so much pain all the time from the arthritis and everything. And I think she became rather impatient with herself, you know, that she couldn't do the things that she once did. She always had very high standards for herself, and I think she expected everyone to have those kinds of high standards. And then there were just constant irritations related to certain things. The problem with the land up above the top house and the landslides and the fact that the hill was encroaching on the houses and the water damage, and, you know, she didn't have the money to take care of it, and she couldn't get any help, it seemed, although she talked to everybody in the world. She had a running lawsuit with a builder for many years. The builder said that, you know, he owned part of this land and blah blah, and it just went drag on for years and years and years. I think that sapped a lot of her energy, and it made her really quite bitter that it seemed like law and justice were two different things. And, you know, this guy had a lot of money, so he could do whatever the hell he pleased, and I think that didn't sit well with her. I tried to help out over the years, and in the late 70s, well, around 1974 through 76, basically. I worked real hard up here trying to come up almost every weekend to help keep things rolling and trying to get something going, to kind of take over the reins, because Lou was getting in poor and poor health at that point. She kept saying, well, the younger people have to get something going. But it was very difficult because she didn't know how to let go. And you could only go so far before Lou would say, that's not the way I want it done. And she didn't seem to understand that if you're asking people to volunteer their time and efforts and energies, that you have to let go. But she wouldn't or couldn't in many cases. And at that point, there was some of the people who'd been active for quite a long period of time got kind of disgusted with the whole situation and basically just kind of backed off. And there were always people up here, but they would kind of change from time to time. And about 1976, I took a job in Tennessee at a small community college down there. I had already graduated, got my master's degree, and taught for a couple of years here in Louisville, both at the elementary level and then at Bellarmine College part-time. And I really kind of wanted to try my hand at college teaching, so took a job at a community college in Gallatin, Tennessee, and was there for about 2 years. So I didn't really see much of Lou for a couple of years. I was always very sad and felt very guilty. It was kind of like I worked as hard as I could with Lou and trying to help, but she became rather negative, and I just couldn't quite cope with it anymore. And it's just kind of like I faded out. One day I just didn't come back. And I felt really guilty about that. Of course, I'm a guilty sort of person, but I didn't see her for almost 2 years, and then I had come back. My ex-wife's family lived in Louisville. I had family in Louisville. And we came back one Christmas and ended up going over to Hal and Kitty Tenney's for a Christmas do, and Lou came. And it was very touchy for a few minutes, and she had gotten a lot older and was on a cane at that point. And by older, she just did, the physical things were starting to get her down. And I was really kind of worried about this interaction, but in a very brief period of time, it was like old issues were forgotten, and we were chatting in a very warm and friendly manner. And I came up later on in the holiday and saw her, and it was very nice. In fact, I think we had some port together. Lou was very fond of Gallo port, and we drank many glasses of it together, and I always hated it. But, Lou liked port, so I would share a glass with her. And she drank a lot of port. I think she had a little bit of a drinking problem at certain times in her life. And, some of that might have been just, the loneliness and everything, and the pain.
And the pain.
She was in a lot of pain. And, she would just ache from the arthritis in the gout. And I think she just tippled a little too much at times. But the port, it was kind of a tradition, having a glass of port with Lou. And I always kidded and I really did feel very close to Lou. And since she didn't have family, I'd often send her a Mother's Day card, for example, or Easter cards and things like that. And she was always very appreciative of that. And I'd bring her things that I'd done when I was in college. It was kind of like a kid, a student bringing their teacher a goodie. She was like a favorite teacher. I'd bring her pottery when I was studying pottery in college, and she always admired my work. When I was studying textiles down at Murray, I like textiles myself in terms of producing them myself, things like dyeing and batik and things like that, much more than weaving because it's too time consuming. But, she'd ask me to come up and do workshops and exhibitions and things like that, and I helped put together, shows and little short workshops and do some teaching. And I believe she really helped me develop as a teacher, watching her work. But anyway, toward the end there, I was living in Tennessee, and I was there for 2 years, and I moved back to Louisville, and that was a real rough time in my life. I was going through a divorce and all this stuff, and I had heard that Lou was very ill, that she'd been diagnosed as having cancer, and I came up a couple of times. I guess it was about, it was the year she died. I came up.
This is the end of side two, take. This is tape two, side one, first interview with Michael Kirk on the history of Lou Tate and the Little Loom House.
After a long period of time of not having seen her, I had heard that she was very ill, and I came out to see her one afternoon, and she was in a slip, I believe. She'd been in bed, and I knocked on the door, and she invited me to come in, said, "Excuse the way I look, but I don't feel very well. You know, is this okay?" And I said, "Oh, sure." And she was telling me about her experiences, some of her experiences being ill, and how she'd had surgery, and she'd been in a nursing home situation for a brief period of time, recovering, and that had been a big eye-opening experience for her. And she had done some, as soon as she got well enough, she went back and started doing a weaving program with the people in the nursing home. And She lost a lot of weight, and you could tell she was very ill, and she talked about how she'd been in a lot of pain and such, but she was, by this point I think she had, she realized that the end was pretty near, and she talked about having read Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book on death and dying, and how she had kind of, you know, made her peace. She knew what was up, and I think, having done that, she'd mellowed tremendously. I didn't see some of the perhaps anger I might have seen earlier on, which was the period when I kind of stopped coming. She just seemed much, much more mellow. And we had a long conversation, and I tried to, she's talked at that time that she was very concerned that so many people had kind of, you know, left here with problems, you know, over the years, and I'd seen many people here for long periods of time, and then there'd be some kind of spat or something, and they'd go off and do their own thing, and Lou, at that point, I think, was really thinking about that, and how this had all happened. She was trying to look at it and see where her flaws had been and what she'd done, and I tried to comfort her and just said, "Lou, you know, you have very high standards, and I respect those standards, and, you know, that creates rubs sometimes, and, you know, I think I tried to diplomatically say you're not the easiest person in the world to get along with if you're angry about something, but, you know, I respect that. That's part of who you are, and I don't care, and I love you anyway." And it was really a very tearful kind of thing. I think she cried a little bit, and I got teary-eyed, because I think she was feeling lonely, and by this time, John and Ann Kuiper were back in her life. I think they had been helping out a great deal, but they had been on the outs before for several, quite a few years, in fact. And there were some people, as there always seemed to be, there were always some people around helping, and, you know, neighbors and old friends. Sue's last name?
Kendrick.
Kendrick. who had been a friend of Lou's for over 50 years, was still around. And even Sue kind of bounced in and out. I mean, they had their ups and downs, but I think their friendship went so far back that there was nothing that would permanently damage it. But Sue and Lou were kind of the same mold. I like Sue, but we had a few run-ins later on with the foundation and such. Well, anyway, this was kind of basically the last time I saw Lou. And said that it was kind of a rough period in my life, and I had intended to come back out and try to do a couple of things for her. There were some problems, as there always were, with things not working or whatever, and I think I had told her I'd try to find someone to help work out an electrical problem or something like that. And then I didn't get, this was in late spring, I think. And then one Sunday morning, I think it was, I was looking at the paper and I saw that she had died the day before. And it really struck me pretty hard because I, you know, again, as I said earlier about the guilt thing, I thought, oh, you know, I didn't see her recently. It had only been a couple months, I guess. And I called my friend Maury. I don't think he'd been up here for a long time either, because again, the kind of negative overtone, and he probably felt kind of guilty too. We're fixers, you know, we want everything to be hunky-dory and Pollyanna-ish. But anyway, when I saw it in the paper, I called Maury. He was the first person I called, and told him that Lou had died, and I saw in the paper there was going to be some little service at one of the area funeral homes, and at first he didn't want to go, and then he said, well, we'll go together. And that was kind of real symbolic, you know, the two of us had been such close friends in college and had done so much together with Lou and everything, but it was kind of an important thing that we did it together. And we went to the service, and it was very interesting walking in, because all of a sudden here were all these people I hadn't seen for a long time, and a lot of people that had had the falling outs and whatever, and it was kind of like, oh my God. It was really a very strange experience to see people I hadn't seen for years and years. I saw it walk in, and there was Ann, Kuiper, and John, and I probably hadn't seen them for 4 years at that time. And Mrs. Kendrick, and just all these people that I'd seen out here over the years. And it was like, I guess, you know, a lot of people, buried the hatchets, as it were, and showed up out of respect for the good times. I mean, anybody who has a bad story about Lou also has at least a handful of good stories. And I think that's just one of the things that made her such a fascinating person. She had a strong-willed character. And you could love her, or you could hate her, or you could love her and hate her. I never hated her, any stretch of imagination. I think the thing that drove me off there for a while was just that it seemed so heavy, and I just didn't know what to do. And what I was doing didn't seem to be enough, and I just couldn't keep up the pace. And because of, you know, my teaching and, you know, my marriage and all these other things. And I finally just kind of thought, you know, I'm not doing that much good the way things are right now, so I'm just going to have to back off. But anyway, after going to the service, it was announced that there'd be a memorial service later on. And the memorial service, where was it held? Here. It was held here on the hill. And that even more people showed up. And, you know, again, different people, and people I hadn't seen for years. And it was just very interesting the way her passing kind of brought some of the old memories and all some of the old fun things back together. And I believe we had kind of like a potluck. I can't remember exactly. So it was kind of like the old rituals survived. And at that point, there was talk about trying to establish a foundation, and a date was set. There was a meeting held, and I called a bunch of people and asked that they come. And we had a meeting, kind of an organizational meeting, and somehow I got roped into being part of the founding board group. And there were kind of new people in the picture at that point. Earl Fowler, who I had met earlier on, had been part of the law firm that had worked with Lou for many years on the lawsuits and such. And so we got together and met in Mr. Fallon's office, and part of the core group was Sally Moss, and who I had known for years, a lot related to through the Loom House, and then other situations. And Sue Kendrick and Bob Douglas and myself and Charles Moberly and Vivian Hyatt, who was another old friend of Lou's, and we worked together to try to get things off the ground. I went through about a year of being quite deeply involved in things out here. It was really tough because I had a pretty demanding job at the time at the Louisville Art Gallery, but I tried to make some contacts and get some things rolling, but it was, again, very frustrating that things seemed to be moving so slowly. I made some contacts with the Smithsonian in Washington with a woman who was a textile conservator there, Rita Drosko. She later came out and visited and was very fascinated with what was going on here. And I tried to get some information on grant writing and things like this. We tried to get the place whipped into some semblance of order to get the program alive again. I came out and helped paint the bottom house and clean it up and sort through years of accumulation of stuff and box it up and get, at that time, top house was in such bad repair that they could no longer hold classes up here. So that first year, our goal was trying to get the bottom house open as a place where people could, you know, go and start weaving again. So I conned people out of paint and went out and, you know, got paint rollers and got a crew together, and we came out and painted and fixed up as best we could on a very limited budget. There was an old tavern table in the basement of the Loom House that Lou had always said that she'd like to have refinished and used, and I refinished that, and we used it as kind of a meeting table, our board table down there. And I did things like brought out an old oriental rug that I had stored and some things like that, trying to just spiffy the place up to the point that we looked creditable, like we were, like it was still alive. And it was a Herculean task just trying to sort through the junk versus the treasures. And to this day, I hope we didn't throw anything away that was important, but there were old boxes of scrap yarn and odds and ends, and we just had to make some hard decisions at that point because literally the bottom house was so crammed full of stuff that you could barely get in the door. And during Lou's illness, a lot of things had slipped, and she was such a notorious pack rat. She never threw anything away, and you worried that you might be throwing away something very important, very historical. But we did our best in trying to clean up the place and box up what we could and take that to the upper level in there. And we patched roofs and raked leaves, and there were a couple of days where I came out and worked in the yard and trimmed trees. Anything we could do to try to make... again, the goal at that point was to try to let people know that something was trying to be formed and to try to make the place look alive. This was before the renovation of Top House, and we just felt it was important to try to get some kind of program going. So a group of people got together and kind of formed an education committee and started doing some teaching again. Thelma Hogan was involved in that, and Vivian and Sally and Sue. And I kind of worked on building and grounds as much as I could at that point. And I worked, as I said, real hard, you know, just trying to do little things to spruce the place up as much as possible and to make it look good. I worked with very intensely with the board for probably a year, maybe it was close to 2 years, I can't remember exactly now. And it was kind of like history repeating itself. I got burned out again. I make my monthly trek out to the board meetings, and it just seemed like we were making so little progress. And there was a lot of nitpicking going on, and some of the people on the board were trying real hard, and other people just seemed to make it to the monthly meeting, and that was it. You know, I was doing everything from tearing down the old bridge that was falling down that connected the house to kind of to the driveway. It was literally falling down, and so I just got crazy one day and came out here and tore the whole thing down and drug it around the edge of the house and threw it down the ravine and covered it with leaves. And Bob Douglas and I hauled truckloads full of garbage out of the place. It was just physically taxing, tiring work. I got so angry one day, I came out and pushed down a tree. It was an old dead tree, and it was sitting there, and I just kind of attacked it and started kicking and hitting at it, and the sucker was so old and rotten, it just fell down. So I took out a lot of aggression on unwanted trees and weeds and such in those days. I really enjoyed some of the people on the board, some of the other people. I just, you know, I got tired of some of the chronic complaining, as it were, and people that, I remember I did the first newsletter for the foundation, and, you know, a couple of people picked on little itzel details. And my point of view at that point was, hey, it's something, it's done, let's move on. And it just never seemed like we could get any momentum going, that we were always a day late, a dollar short, there was no money to do some of the things, and there just wasn't the time. And these were the days when, you know, people were mumbling, well, we need a full-time director, and I would have loved to try to have gotten involved and do something out here, but we didn't have any money and didn't really have the time to pursue the money. And I've always thought that this place would be a wonderful source. It could be a valuable resource for the community as a historical place. Lou's collection, I think, is very interesting and very significant. I, at that time, invited Karen Boyd, who's the weaving professor at Murray, to come up and look the place over. She was amazed. She thought it was just a treasure house of history, both the coverlets and just Lou, the history of Lou and that whole period. Karen was very interested, but since she was in Murray, it made, you know, following up on anything pretty difficult. But we did invite, for example, another person from the Murray area, Sally something, who was a member of the National Hand Weavers Guild or Coverlet Guild.
Sally Guy.
Guy, to come up. And, you know, people are interested, but there's never been anyone who's had the kind of time to spearhead it and pull all the loose ends together. And this place has so many loose ends, it's not funny. And so it became very frustrating, and I kind of bowed out for a while. And I think Bob Douglas and I both burned out after about an intensive year period. Bob was able, though, to go ahead and spearhead some of the presentations that kind of got the money to do the renovation on Top House. So, you know, I have nothing but a great deal of respect for Bob's energy and commitment. And he was going through some tough times then, too, with the death of his father and some things like that. And I don't know, there's something about this place that kind of eats people up and spits them out. I don't mean that in a bad way, but, you know, you can only do that so long before you just really get tired. And as I say, you know, having a job, it'd be very different if someone could really devote all their energy to it. But who can? There's not another Lou around. And, that's part of the problem, I think, with the ongoing organization is the lack of someone who has the time to, you know, pull it all together. Some of this has become kind of negative, you know, about all the problems, and I'd like to end up by saying that my good memories of the Loom House far outweigh any of the sadder memories. Lou was a constant delight in her appreciation of little things. She loved birds, and she always fed birds, and she didn't like squirrels because they got in and chewed up things, but kind of my real image, the really strong image of Lou, is her standing at the back door of the lower house and throwing out bird seed for the cardinals and calling them, and she'd go, here, red birdie, 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 here, birdie, birdie, birdie. And that kind of thing has stuck with me long after some of the other things. And just the wonder of being around someone that I really enjoyed so much. And as I say, she inspired me to look at things in a lot of different ways. And sitting out on the picnic tables up here and talking to Lou and just enjoying the hill, the trees, the wind. It was always a very wonderful experience just being up here with Lou. I just remember long, rambling conversations that about this, that, and the other that went on, and just how much I enjoyed being around her. I remember many nights sitting out on the porch, as she called it, up here. She had an old day bed out there, and when the weather was really hot, a lot of times she'd come up here and sleep because it would get good breezes. And I just remember sitting out there, and she'd be propped up, and we'd talk and talk and talk and talk. And those memories are very special. I just have flashes of Lou out with the birds or the jonquils in the spring, and I'd bring flowers for the open house sometime. There was an old cut glass vase that she used to put irises in the spring and things like that. So I have a kind of an interesting, no pun intended, tapestry of little bits and pieces of very pleasant memories about her. And when I got engaged, she threw a party for us, and Lou didn't entertain much in those later years, but when she did entertain, she'd do chili, and she had a chili supper for us, and this was all accomplished on a hot plate, two-burner hot plate. She made this wonderful, wonderful, thick stew-like chili with lots of beef, and she used lasagna noodles in it, and that was just a great time. She never owned a table, so she'd push all the loom stands together and make a huge table in the center of the room and pull up the loom benches, and there must have been 15 or 20 people at it, and it was just such a wonderful evening. It was great fun, lots of wine and good chili, and she served the chili in old family china and wonderful silver and all this, and that's kind of the essence of Lou's style, that one side that was so unconventional, and yet she could pull it off, and she had great style in her own way, but it was her style. I remember that evening so clearly, the beautiful white linen tablecloths thrown across all the loom stands, and just little attention to detail, that was part of Lou's gift to other people, I think, was just exposing them to lots of different things, lots of things that you wouldn't have seen or known about if you hadn't known her. And I do think that, she opened my eyes to looking at things, to asking questions, and perhaps even to problem solving, looking at things and figuring out how to do them. My memories of Lou are very, very warm. And really can visualize her out there calling to the birds, and I hear one of the cardinals up the hill right now. He's probably a descendant of that ancient one that used to come and visit Lou every afternoon to get his snacks. And so that kind of, there is a history and a tradition that carries on even now. And, coming up here and seeing the, some of the progress has been made, more needs to be done naturally, but it's like it all lives on through her and through the hill, and the seasons come and go, but there's a certain timeless quality up here on the hill, and some things have deteriorated, other things have been repaired, But it still has that flavor, that kind of very magical feel. And I hope the place will always survive in one form or the other. You know, if the foundation ultimately can't keep it going, I hope another Lou Tate type would fall heir to it. You know, even if it wasn't always a weaving cabin, I just think it's such a special place, you know, if an artist could live here or something. But I think it's a very rare and special place, and it needs to be preserved somehow.
This is the end of take 2, side 1, interview with Michael Kirk.